the Tommies, the order is forever.
Welcome on in to Tommy's Holiday Camp. It is another Friday night and it's 7 o'clock. And I'm putting on my other hat as Arnaldo, your host of Tommy's Holiday Camp on Cows Radio 107.3 FM, coming to you from wonderful downtown Occidental. I have a wonderful show to you for you today. And I want to say thank you for Stephen for hosting with me on Laura's.
You're welcome. I loved it.
Occidental Living Room.
Great co-host.
Thank you. And cohort as well. So 874-1073 is the phone number in the studio. And coming right up, we have a very special guest who is just called in. Laura's speaking to him right now. It is Mark White of the Strawberry Alarm Clock. Yeah, from that great 60s band. So right now, I'm going to flick on their great hit, Incense and Peppermint. And then we're going to speak to Mark White.
Of mankind, dead kings, many things I can't define. Old cages, fires, wagons, butter your mind. Incense and peppermints, the color of time.
Who cares what games we choose? Little to win, but nothing to lose.
Incense and peppermints, meaningless mounds. Turn on, tune in, turn your eyes around.
Look at your song, look at your song.
Yeah,
yeah. Look at your song, look at your song. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Tune by the cockeyed world in two. Throw you by the one side, the least you can do. Beatniks and politics, nothing is new. A yardstick for lunatics, one point of view.
Hello, Mark.
Hey, it's me.
Hello, Mark.
Nice to be chatting with you here.
Can you hear me, Mark?
You're loud and clear, buddy.
Oh, okay. I just had the headphones on down. Great to speak to you, Mark. Thanks so much for calling in.
No problem. You're distorting, like you're pushing the VU meter right up to the top there, though.
Okay. Oh, okay. I've run it down now. Getting too excited, you know.
So what's happening up there?
Well, we're having a great time in Occidental. We have a farmer's market every Friday night, so there's lots of people milling around, buying lots of organic produce and some fabulous things, actually.
You're getting me hungry now.
I know. There's a world-famous paella, which people line up, like 60, 70 people line up to get it when it's ready.
Nice. Sounds good.
Indeed. So thank you so much for calling, Mark. And, well, you're...
My
pleasure. You're a part of rock history.
So people have said. I can't get used to it, but you know, when you were in it at the time, you had no idea what you were doing. But you knew that you were doing something that people liked. Looking back now, it's quite a. I guess it was quite an accomplishment at that young age to come up with something like that, you know?
Well, how old were you when you first got into, what inspired you to become a musician, to pick up, to start playing keyboards?
Wow. When I was 7 years old, I saw on a black and white television in North Hollywood, California. I think it was about 1952. My parents got a little black and white television set, one of the early models, and I saw Liberace play the piano. And I said, "Mom, I want to do that."
But did you want the sparkly jacket as well?
No, I never did any of that. But I liked the sound of the piano, and I that's what actually got me interested in playing. And my mom, about a year later, got a piano, and I took lessons till I was about 16.
Mm. And so were the other members of the band just school friends? How did you get together?
The band, I entered when I was I guess I was about 20. I had already had a couple of local bands that we put together. It was just some friends. There was a music store, a local music store, and you answer an ad that's up on the bulletin board. And after a few of those bands, I felt I was, I think I was hitting about 21 years old there. I felt I was ready for something, a little better than I had some experience and had bought a Hohner electric piano that was kind of one of the cutting edge keyboards at the time, just for the small Italian organs came on the market, like the Farfisa and the Vox Continental, which the Farfisa came out of Italy and the Vox came out of England, made famous by quite a few groups. One that comes to mind is like the Dave Clark Five used it, and of course the Doors, Ray Manzarek used it on Light My Fire. So those were some of the early keyboards I bought. But I answered an ad at a music store, and I did an audition for a band called The Sixpence, just like the English coin. And it was a band out in Glendale, California, which is very close to where I lived. And they didn't have a keyboard player, and they hired me. And a few months later, we changed the name of the Strawberry Alarm Clock. But as far as when I actually got serious about music was when I was about 21.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, interesting progression.
Yeah, the rest of the guys in the band were, no one was over 18 years old.
Oh, so you were the granddaddy of them.
Yep, and half the time I was having to keep them in line.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, they didn't like that at all, but somebody had to do it. It was an ugly job. But somebody had to do.
Yeah, trying to keep a bunch of 18-year-olds in line.
Well, there were a few that barely were turning 18. They were still 17.
Oh, my goodness. So, like, some of the gigs you played, I suppose you couldn't drink in some of the places where you actually played?
Yeah. None of them. No, they were all teen nightclubs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So what type of place? It was in L.A. So obviously this mid-60s was an amazing scene in L.A. at that time. What was your experience of that scene?
Well, I'm going to try to give you the short version.
Okay.
Let's see. This was a melting pot. Los Angeles, Hollywood specifically was a real melting music, whether it was... any type of music, especially on the leading edge of the flower power movement, was right here in Los Angeles, kind of cousin to San Francisco scene, I guess. And I'm sure it was happening in other areas, but it seemed like there was a proliferation of some of the best bands back then I have ever heard in the Hollywood area. And we were lucky to be a part of that. All the clubs were happening. There's a lot of hit records. The bands were, you name the bands, they were here. The Birds, I can't even begin to, Love with, Arthur Lee. These were some of the bands that we were, listening to while at the same time. I mean, there was a whole list of bands that were playing out here, and off the top of my head right now, I don't want to, try to dig out, dig out all these names and name drop, but we were always in awe of the bands that had records on the radio, that had airplay.
Right.
We always, everybody's dream is to actually hear yourself on a major radio station. and that is in a big metropolitan area, very difficult to get airplay on a song back in those days unless you were really liked by the program director or the there was an organization that actually told the big radio stations back in those days, like KHJ, Boss Radio, they told them what to play.
Oh my goodness. They got
a playlist that came from a central place. So they, in the big sprawling metropolitan area like this, you didn't go to the station, knock on the door, come on in, boys, have a seat, I'll spin your record for you. You know, it wasn't like that here. You might be able to do that up and down the California coast, but not in Los Angeles.
Yeah. And how did you manage? Like, did you have an agent, manager, or did you do it yourself?
No. Back in those days, it was basic setup was a manager, and then you had a producer that produced you in the studio. And our manager was, he was the manager of the Sixpence when I joined the group. Now, these guys all lived in Glendale area, went to school in that area in high school together, and he was a manager of a food market, and they happened to work there, and they when they got the band together, he says, I'll manage you guys. And that's how that happened, and that's who our manager was. He was basically, he worked in a market that turned a manager for a band. He was a manager at the local food market in I think La Crescenta, California.
Oh, I love it.
So, anyway, when I joined the band, they were the Sixpence was actually. You can find there are pressings out there of an album that has all the Sixpence songs on it. It's on the A Karma label. That's A K A R M A. It was pressed in Italy, put out by our ex manager. And it has all the Sixpence. It's T-H-E-E-S-I-X-P-E-N-C-E. The Sixpence. It has every original and cover song of some of the English bands that the Sixpence did was put out on a vinyl LP.
Oh, wow. Where did you record that?
That wasn't... those songs were recorded previous to me. Except with the exception of one song called Heartful of Rain, they were recorded previous to me joining the band.
Oh, okay.
And I sang on a song called, and I wrote this song called Heartful of Rain when I first got into the group, and that was put out. Unfortunately, didn't go anywhere, but it was under the All American label, which was the original label of our manager, Bill Holmes, his name was. It was recorded at a budget studio, you know, it was a very low-end studio, and sound in those days left a little bit to be desired, but it was an honest attempt, and a lot of people like it because it is full garage sound. If someone's into garage music, this was the ultimate in garage for 1966.
Wow, beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah.
Now,
but,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, carry on.
I was going to go from there. The name Strawberry Alarm Clock, people always ask us how we got the name.
Well, that's it. You know, that's all tied in with the whole psychedelic scene, I assume. So I'm wondering how that you got into all that.
It's kind of interesting when you say psychedelic scene. Yes, that was looking back, like that's what it was called. When we were in it, we just were a band. The label Psychedelic was attached to us. I think later, or shortly thereafter, Incense and Peppermints, interesting story on that song. I don't know how much time we have.
Oh, as much time as you like, Mark. Don't worry.
All right.
This is public radio, so I'm in full control of the board.
Well, for those listeners out there that are listening and want to hear the story about Incense and Peppermints, I'd be more than happy to... continue on with this.
Absolutely, yes.
All right, I'm gonna try to edit this down a little bit. when we were ready to put out a song that had, it was an instrumental that I came up with the music, and Ed King, our guitar player, which later went on to Leonard Skinner, and wrote the lick to Sweet Home Alabama, which is everybody knows. And, well, Ed lived very close to me, and I was, when I was writing the music, Jim Sims and Peppermints, by the way, there was no title on that song. I was writing a original song, no title.
Okay.
Ed came over, and I called him over, and I said, Ed, I'm having trouble with the bridge on this song. That's the middle part of a song, for those out there that don't know song structure. But every song usually has the verses, and then a bridge or a chorus, they call it sometimes. There's an introduction, and then there's an outro, we call it, or an ending.
Hmm.
And what happened was I had the little kind of the Asian kind of lick at the front of that where it goes dun 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 dun, dun. And that just came out of my head, and you know, and I was writing this on a regular standard spin it piano at my parents at my folks' house in Van Nuys, California. And I had a guest house in the back where we used to rehearse, where we had all our equipment set up. And I was in the house one day, and I came up with this little song and this little introduction. And I said, wow, this is kind of catchy. And I called Ed over, and I said, Ed, I got this song I'm working on. Can you come over and help me? And he goes, sure. So he drives over, and we sit down. And in 10, 15 minutes, he comes up with a bridge. And that's the part where, well, anyway. If anybody knows Instance of Peppermints, they can figure out what part it is.
They mostly know.
or if they want to refresh themselves by listening to it. But
I had it on just before you came on.
Oh, great. So we pretty much had the song down instrumentally, but had no lyrics to it.
Mm.
So we played the song for our producer, Frank Slay, which was a new producer. He also produced people like Freddie Cannon, which had quite a few hits over the years. Tallahassee Lassie, he had a whole bunch of string of hits.
Sea Cruise.
And, and then later he did The Music Machine, a song called Talk Talk, and Green Eyed Lady. So anyway, Frank Slay, and he had people before that in the 50s that he used to produce, but what he did was he listened to it, and he had these two guys that called themselves the Rainy Days.
Huh.
They had a novelty song called Acapulco Gold. Hmm. Now, back in those days, nobody knew what Acapulco Gold stood for. And that song was getting some airplay until people found out that it Acapulco Gold stood for a kind of a type of marijuana. And at that point, they pulled it off the L.A. airplay because, of course, you know, that was going to corrupt the minds of people.
Right.
And we didn't want to, and they didn't want anything that was, I guess, against the FCC regulations at the time to play songs like that. But, which was pretty funny when you look back now. But he sent a reel-to-reel a quarter-inch tape back to Colorado Springs, Colorado, where two guys, John Carter and Tim Gilbert, which wrote that song, Acapulco Gold, and they had some other songs out, and the band was named, was called The Rainy Days. I think it's spelled D-A-Y-Z.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent it back with an acoustic guitar arrangement of what they had titled Incense and Peppermints with the lyrics on it. So we went into Frank Slay's office one day on Hollywood Boulevard. He called us up and he goes, boys, I think I got our song together. I got some lyrics for it. So why don't you come up to my office and we'll listen to it. So he puts it on his old fashioned stereo with the two speakers up on the wall. And he plays this two track reel to reel. I think it was in mono. Is a single track.
Yeah.
And we listened to it back, and he sang Incense and Peppermints for the first time to the music that we had sent him, but he played it on an acoustic six-string guitar.
Hmm.
No other accompaniment, no drums, no keyboard, nothing. So we said, wow, yeah, we like it. So shortly thereafter, we go into the studio, and at that time we were using it's called Original Sound Studio on Sunset near La Brea. It was owned by Art LeBeau. Art LeBeau was the guy that put out all those oldie records that had all the real oldies from the 50s. He put out a series of them.
Okay.
That if you wanted oldies, they always came from Art LeBeau. They were Original Sound was the name of his label.
Hmm.
Anyway, that's where we recorded. He was just, he got a brand new 8-track machine in, reel-to-reel 8-track. Everything was just coming off of the 4-track days.
Mm.
So this was pretty cutting-edge stuff.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, he recorded it still in mono.
Huh.
So there, to this day, there isn't a stereo recording out there of Incense of Peppermint that hasn't been doctored, you know, through frequency response changing or electronic,
enhancement or whatever,
digitizing of it. But who knew that it would ever become a number one hit? And so what he decided to do was put it out in mono. Even on our album later on, it was put on there in mono, which was quite a disappointment to us because everything else was in stereo.
Yeah.
But we recorded the song, and then when it came time to lay down the vocal, we all tried, we took a go at trying to see who sounded best on it.
Hmm.
We all stood in front of the big Sennheiser condenser mic, and and we all took a try, and nobody really sounded that great.
Huh.
And oddly enough, there was a 15-year-old kid sitting with a friend of our manager, Bill Holmes, that had just kind of trying to start his own band, and he was quite young. And we said, Greg, why don't you make an attempt at this? So we put the lyrics on the music stand and said, okay, run the tape. And Greg sang it, I think it was the second take, huh. And it was a keeper. And we played it back, and then we go, oh, my God, here's a guy that's not even in the band that sounds the best on the song. So we kept it.
Oh,
so
wow.
Who knew, of course, down the road it was going to be a number one hit. And, you know, Greg wasn't in the band. He actually never joined the band. He was never asked to join the band.
Oh, wow.
And we started playing Incense and Peppermints when we did our live gigs, and it was starting to catch on a little bit. We had our manager had a good friend up in a radio station, KIST, in Santa Barbara. It was a small 5,000-watt station that really couldn't get more than, I would say, 30 or 40 miles in either direction.
Mm.
And due to the coastline where it was situated. And we used to go up and play these clubs, teen clubs, up in Santa Barbara area, which is about a 90-mile drive from Los Angeles.
Right.
And he put us on the air. He put Incense and Peppermints on his radio station. He had full control of what he can play and what he couldn't play. And before you know it, we had our first radio airplay. And from then on, they were starting to get some people calling in, and we had some of our friends call in to try to get him to play it. And as soon as we started up the coast and took the song up to some other clubs up in Pismo Beach area, and then through Santa Maria and Pismo Beach, and then up into San Luis Obispo County, and then as we went farther up to Tulare, Modesto, and we worked our way up the coast, had some gigs, and we were trying to get the smaller radio stations to play Incense Peppermints, and they were very obliging.
So you were barnstorming, basically.
Yes, I mean, we were pounding the pavement hard. I mean, you literally had to drive up to the small radio station, walk in, and, talk to the DJs and all that kind of stuff. We had some bookings here in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
At some of the larger nightclubs, we were lucky enough to get on and play some of our original songs. And we were recording. We got a Incense and Peppermints, our manager, originally put it out, released that song on the All American label, and shortly thereafter, Uni Records, he went to them, and they were interested in the record. And before you know, we had a contract with Universal City Records. It was the Uni label. They had just signed Elton John, who was a nobody knew him at all. He was a total unknown. And Hugh Masekela just had a hit on Uni Records called Grazing in the Grass, which was a huge hit. Well, Uni Records gave us a contract. We went into the studio very quickly. In 2 weeks, we had to come up with an album full of songs. And so all of us, the members of the band, got together, myself, Mark Weitz, the bass player, George Bunnell, and Randy Seal, the drummer, let's see, who was in the storyline? Oh, Ed King, of course. How could I forget Ed, my writing buddy? and Lee Freeman. Lee Freeman was also guitar and vocals and harmonica. And Lee contributed a lot to the band, George, bass player, and myself. And even an early member that played on one of our first albums was Steve Bartek. At 15 years old, he played flute on one of our songs, and he went on to be one of the main guys with Danny Elfman in Oingo Boingo.
Oh, wow.
And Danny, of course, has graduated long since Oingo Boingo into motion picture and television musical scores and is doing fabulous. And Steve is his right-hand man doing arranging and composing with him. Mm. Well, when Steve was 15 years old, he played on our album. And to this day, Steve still is, we are using his recording studio. 2.5 years ago, we reformed. And Steve is now in the original Strawberry Alarm Clock.
Oh, wonderful. It's come back around.
It's a really interesting journey.
Oh, wonderful. Now, in that part of L.A. where you're from, if my memory serves me right, out there in Glendale, whatever, wasn't that where Zappa and Captain Beefheart and David Gates went to high school or something together, or college?
Well, you know, I'm not up on all that trivia. I'm sorry to say, you know, I never really paid much attention to it. It seems that more people know about that stuff that are non-musicians, or some are musicians, but than actual musicians ourselves. You know,
right.
That was all the trivia stuff that everybody seemed to know. All I can say is that Hollywood was where most of the clubs were that we played.
Hmm.
And there was a club called the Hullabaloo Club.
Oh, yeah.
Originally, it was called Ciro's. That's where we pretty much spotlighted our big debut in Hollywood.
Mm.
All the big groups would play at the Hullabaloo Club. Originally, it was called Ciro's Nightclub. Very huge in the 50s. And it turned into rock and roll. And they had after hours. Mm. They had a stage that revolved. So when one band was finishing up their last song, it would revolve around and the new band would come on playing.
Oh, no setup time.
It was great. And it was set up with the seating, and the standing area was set up like arena style that went from a higher area and back. There was a balcony. It was great.
Mm.
One of the best venues I could remember. The acoustics were great in there. Also, there was the Pandora's Box was another place that was very popular, very small inn club in Deep Hollywood, and very localized. A lot of local bands played there, and also another club called the Brave New World, where Arthur Lee and Love got started, and the Doors of Perception, shortened to the Doors later with Jim Morrison, of course, was at the Whiskey A Go-Go. They were like a house band there.
Wow. So all of a sudden,
this is all happening in about 2 mile stretch.
Exactly. This is such a huge
Sunset
culture.
Boulevard was really where it's happening. Hollywood Boulevard was, of course, popular for tourists, but Sunset was Sunset was where all the clubs were, mainly off of Sunset, between Sunset and Hollywood Boulevard back in those days.
Right, because that's where the... Sorry. Yeah, because that's where that For What It's Worth was written about, wasn't it? The when the police attacked all the kids on Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, God, you know, I don't know what particular instance you're talking about, but there, you know, there was all kinds of stuff that went on later on when peace protests came out, right, breaking against the Vietnam War and stuff like that, which I was too busy all the time. You know, I didn't really keep up with what was happening. You know, I wasn't, I was definitely not, I was against the war, but but I didn't really participate in any of the anti-war
events and things, yeah.
Whatever you call them.
Protests, I suppose, yeah.
Protests, yeah. Well, thank you. I was at a loss of words there.
Well, it must have been amazing. All of a sudden, you've got a number one hit around the world. I mean,
well, it wasn't all of a sudden. I kind of left off on the story. We got off on a tangent here. My fault. Let's see. We couldn't get the. I think I left off where we couldn't get Incense of Peppermints on LA airplay. I mean, we tried everything in the world, and luckily there was a underground radio station on call letters were KBLA, and there was a underground. He played songs that weren't really on the main playlist on the top 40 stations, and it was growing in popularity. People would call in their requests. A lot of local bands, he would play their songs. His name was Dave Diamond. That was the DJ's name, and he called it the Diamond Mind. And he would play a lot of what I guess are termed more of the underground psychedelic and a lot of the hip in bands that were happening in Hollywood. And we went and talked to Dave Diamond, and it worked on request. He had a quest line, so we got everybody we knew to call in on their quest line and flood the station with as many calls as we can, as people we had, and we pounded that station day after day. Finally, you know, he started playing it, and it was playing it more and more, and I think some of the other stations were getting pressure on their request line. And eventually, the song started, it hit the, we were playing actually all over the United States at that time on some tours out of state, and we were starting to climb, we started to, Billboard Magazine actually got us on the bubbling under, which is getting close to the top 100. And before you knew it, we hit the charts, and we were getting a lot of nationwide airplay from, it was easier in the Midwest, got in Nebraska, Kansas, Michigan, Wisconsin. We were getting airplay around the country. And the pressure eventually of actually getting onto Billboard charts, we got some rotation on some of the local big radio stations, and we were doing probably 12 to 15 television shows trying to bolster that up. We did Jonathan Winters, Smothers Brothers. We did the Steve Allen Show, Joey Bishop, a lot of the other, Woody Woodbury. There was a lot of local big shows that were syndicated nationwide that we were lucky enough to have our the agents that were handling us at the time was the William Morris and William Morris Agency. We were signed to them, one of the largest agencies in the world for talent. We were very lucky that they got us on some major television shows, which helped our popularity tremendously. Our look with the East Indian Kurtas, they're called, K-U-R-T-A-S. They're not Nehru. A lot of people call, call them a Nehru jacket. I guess you know, some people call it that. But that whole look came up from a shop in Westwood, California, not far from Hollywood, that made custom-made Indian, East Indian clothes. And at the time, Ravi Shankar and the Beatles were actually in some of the photos that you can find of them on their trip to the Maharishi in India. You can see them wearing similar outfits like that, or shirts and they're called kurtas. And there was a shop that we said, wow, those are cool. And that's where we did our first album cover. We actually shot it in the store with bolts of material around us. And that chair that was in our first album cover, that was all in the shop. And so that's how that happened. And that's how our dress kind of acquiesced that direction. And we still, to this day, we found the gal, Kathy, of Sat Purush Designs. She lives out near Palm Springs. She's rekindled her business, and she now makes those. You can buy them online. Satparush, S-A-T-P-A-R-U-S-H is the label, the same label that she had back in 1967 in her shop with her husband on Westwood Boulevard in Westwood.
Oh, my goodness.
And near UCLA. Out here in Los Angeles, and Kathy's in touch. She's come to our gigs, and we still buy our kerchiefs from that we wear on stage. 40 years later.
Oh, I love it. That is beautiful.
Well, to zoom ahead, do you have any other questions back in those days before I fill you in what we're doing now?
You had this amazing success. Did you go to other countries? I mean, how did you ride that success?
Yeah, we actually, I guess our big claim to fame for ourselves is we toured just about almost every state in the union here, and sometimes on multiple times we've been back. We were lucky enough to be, when our song went to number one nationwide on the top Billboard 100, we were asked amazingly by the Beach Boys to join them on two different tours on two occasions to open for them, and along with them we were really lucky to have the Buffalo Springfield and Neil Young and that whole band with Stephen Stills and Richie Furay and it was amazing. We had a three band tour, one time for 2 weeks and another time for 6 weeks. We played colleges, venues, big state fairs. Pretty amazing.
Wow.
Traveled on the Beach Boys' own private four-engined aircraft. They had a DC-6 back then that we traveled on, and it was converted inside, kind of like a living room with passenger seats in the back. Incredible, incredible tour. Luckily, I took a few photos of it, so I have a few little souvenirs of that tour.
Oh, good.
But it was rubbing elbows with people like Neil Young and Mike Love and Al Jardine and Carl Wilson and just incredible talent. Even the captain from Captain and Tennille, Daryl Dragon, was on the second tour playing keyboard.
Oh, beautiful!
He's an amazing keyboardist. He was on the second tour. Hmm. So I mean, we were really beating a path. All this stuff was, back in those days, was kind of like musically, a lot of the stuff hasn't been done before. So we were kind of on the leading edge of mixing groups together, like, the Buffalo Springfield, the Psychedelic Band, the Strawberry Alarm Clock, and the Beach Boys. Just a great tour, and it was very successful.
Oh, amazing. What a lovely experience.
Mm-hmm.
So now, I suppose, obviously, success is ephemeral, and so I know you eventually broke up after a fairly short time.
Yeah. To cut to the chase, I guess, so we don't put some of our KOWC fans asleep out there if they haven't fell asleep yet. the band in 1970, I left the band. We fired our manager, the original manager, for incompetence. He was booking us. I'll give you an example. We were in Miami Beach, Florida on Friday night, Honolulu, Hawaii on Saturday night, and Sunday night we were back in Orlando, Florida.
Oh, my God.
Now, that's a total of 18 hours in the air and very few hours on the ground in between, and we just felt we were being herded around like cattle, and we couldn't, pardon the pun there. And I just couldn't... the band, the consensus was, this is not right. We needed to be treated like humans,
Yeah.
And we let him go for basically incompetence, and the band shortly after that threw a lot of lawsuits and cross-complaints. We ran into some financial difficulty, and the band disbanded at that point, 1970. And shortly thereafter, four of the original members carried on the band was the original drummer that drummed on Incense and Peppermints. His name was Gene Gunnels. That left the band shortly after the song was recorded. Hmm. So Randy Field, that came in as our new drummer, actually didn't actually play on Incense and Peppermints, but he rode the wave of success on it. Gene came back, and Lee Freeman and Ed King and a new member, Paul Marshall, came into the band, and they continued on as the Strawberry Alarm Clock, minus the keyboard player. Hmm. So they stayed together for a little while. I think it was a year or two, and they disbanded probably somewhere between 72 and 74. I kind of lost track in there.
Yeah.
And I left the music business at that point when I left the band. Came back in 85 when I was asked to rejoin the band. It had a couple of new members. We wrote 25 new songs and disbanded 3 months later due to the fact that the producer that the guys had got, Lee Freeman and another member of the band, had a manager, and they wrote the songs. I came on instead of a integral member of the group and songwriting contributor. I came on kind of as a sideman, just to add my complimentary playing for whatever I do in my own style to the songs that they wrote, while trying to run my own business, which is not associated with the music business. So I did that really religiously. 5 days a week we rehearsed for 3 months, had two very successful gigs, and then the band disbanded shortly thereafter. By 86, the band was dissolved. George Bunnell, our bass player, and Randy Seal, the drummer, went on to form...